Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education and Finance Committee to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but so we will not take action on the first bill and formally move it. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2468, the Vogel Bill. And before you start, Representative Vogel, if we could have Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, please do a brief overview of the history of this matter and what your bill attempts to do, and then we'll move to you, Representative Vogel, for your presentation and any testifiers you may or may not have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, this bill repeals Section 127A50. Mr. Chair and members.
For those members who do not have all statutory references memorized,
Mr. Chair and
Mr.
members.
Mr. Crow, please talk about what 127A50 is. And the
127A50 is a series of adjustments to school districts' general education revenue related to pension contributions. Consider it the employer contributions to for their faculty and public employees. There are four adjustments that are made in that statute, and they're outlined in the bill summary. Basically, for most school districts, excluding districts and cities of the first class, the adjustment is a negative adjustment that's made as a result primarily of a reduction in 1997 of the employer contribution into TRA. And the reason that it primarily affects districts that are not in cities of the first class is because at that time those districts all had their own pension plans, so those adjustments to TRA didn't impact them. So what happened then is that there were a couple of other adjustments that went the other way, where we increased the employer share, the employer contribution, and that happened in PERA that those cities of the first class qualified for. And with all of these, or the reason that the adjustments have a fiscal impact is that in some cases when we make these employer adjustments, and not in all cases, because for example in 2010 we made an increase in required an increase in employer contributions without providing additional funding, but in these cases, in order to either prevent a windfall or basically fund the additional required contribution, the state added or subtracted money from school districts. So in the biggest piece was this 1997 reduction, where the employer contribution was reduced. Absent any other change, that would have left the amount equal to that reduction in school district budgets to spend on other things. The legislature instead reduced the general education funding to those districts by the amount of those contributions, so it didn't provide them with additional revenue. So it was kind of out of one hand, out of another, rather than resulting in added revenue to the districts. In the same way, in some of the increased contribution times, when the legislature said you have to provide additional contributions, the state provided additional funding for those contributions so that it wouldn't reduce districts' budgets. And as I said before, that's not always the case. And so the total adjustments under this section net to about $31 million, and there's a printout in your packet that shows on a district-by-district basis how that affects each school district. It averages about $37 per pupil, but it varies depending on what the contribution was and what the pupil counts have done in those school districts since that big change in 1997. Obviously, they've in a lot of cases there are significantly fewer pupils, so you might see a real big per pupil adjustment there. You'll also note that in Minneapolis District 1, St. Paul District 625, and in Duluth District 709, those are the three districts that have increases. So the $31 million reduction is a net increase, or is a decrease for those three districts. So basically, where you see a negative, the repeal of that of this section results in additional funding in the amount of the negative dollar amount to the school district. If there's a positive in those three cities of the first class, the repeal of the adjustment takes money away from those three school districts. And I had something else I was going to say, and I can't think of it. So,
well, you can interrupt at any time, Mr. Carroll. Right. So we'll do all that. That's the complete. Mr. Strom, did you have anything to add before we move to Representative Vogel?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add is that the provision in statute does expire in 2020 if it's not otherwise amended.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. That's a brief overview from staff to your presentation and your testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, I'm glad to be here before you, and I actually have a testifier with me, Superintendent John Tyne from the Roseville Area Schools, and thought maybe I'd let Mr. Tyne share a little bit first, and then I'll recap.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is John Tyne. I'm privileged to serve as Superintendent of Schools in Roseville. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me a few moments of your time to represent the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. This is a topic of great interest to me, since I am probably one of the few remaining superintendents who happened to be here in 1997 to see this law brought to light or to be enacted.
Is that what you do in your chair?
My father always told me that if somebody tells you that it's not about money, guess what? It's about money. And this is about money, and it's money for our kids. Right now, on the formula for Roseville Area Schools, it states that we receive 52-24. And I am surely not an expert in school finance like Tom Melcher, but I know that our deduct is about $55 and $60 per student, and that's better than it used to be. The trouble that we have in schools is trying to explain funding. It can be very interesting at times. It's not one of my favorite pastimes. Telling citizens that the amount stated is not exactly correct leads to mistrust and claims of a shell game. We're very interested, or our board's very interested, in working very hard to be transparent, to support open government, and also fairness within districts. This deduct, and I'll call it a deduct, I don't know if that's the proper terminology, leads to misunderstandings and the message that there's some sort of a secret code, or at best, a silent handshake between school district and others. And
it's Superintendent, we don't discuss the secret code in front of the visitors.
Okay. So. I'm sorry, and I apologize for bringing that up.
Yeah, don't tell us.
Please continue with your testimony.
Okay. lastly, yes, it is about money, and I think you have a printout, and I just happened to look at the ideas report, and I happen to do that once a month and take a look. Roseville Area Schools has a deduct of about $381,000 each year, and previously it was higher than that. And if I take a look at that over the last decade, that amounts into easy excess of over $4 million to our district. That $4 million would do many things for us, but just to give you one small example would be every student in our district, all 6,700 of them, would be able, E through K, E through 12, would be able to have an iPad. And so the funding that has not showed up, it's not the end of the world. But as my colleagues will tell you, this has always been a burr for me, and it's been very uncomfortable. I don't think it's fair, and there are some schools where there isn't a deduct. I don't want to belabor the point. I just want to take a minute to thank you for bringing this bill up, Representative, and know that I support it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about how it affects my district or AMSD members or MASA.
Thank you, Superintendent. We'll take testimony from Representative Vogel's presentation as well as the public, and then we'll move to member questions after that. So thank you very much. Representative Vogel, do you have any additional testifiers?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and move to member questions. Are there any questions for members of the committee? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Anything that Superintendent John Tyne from Roseville Area Schools is for, so am I.
Did we get that on tape?
That's good.
Yes.
There, I don't know if that's good or bad. I think it's good.
Thank you. Any other questions for members of the committee? And do we have a quorum now?
We didn't.
Okay. We have a quorum, members. So with that, we'll call the meeting to order, and the chair will move House File 2468 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Any additional comments for members of the committee? Representative Vogel, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, just for hearing this bill, and I believe it would be a good bill to send a good message to our smaller schools around the state. I thank you for it.
Thank you. With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2468 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Vogel, and thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 2647, the Myra bill. Good afternoon, Representative Myra. Representative Myra moves House File 2647 be recommended to pass and referred to the Civil Law Committee. Is that correct, Representative Myra?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Myra, please proceed.
House File 2647 has come to light from a situation that has developed in my House district in Independent School District 191 in a settlement agreement with a HR employee. There was a significant sum of money as part of the settlement, greater than $250,000, and parents and taxpayers alike have wanted transparency. The school board wants to be transparent as possible within the constraints of the law, but there are many questions left unanswered. The bill, House File 2647, is an amendment or change to Section 13.43, Subdivision 2. It is on line 2.1. We are striking settlement of any dispute and opening up the language to add clarity for transparency. If there is a buyout agreement, if there's a settlement agreement, or if there's an agreement settling any dispute, that would be public information if the payout is more than $10,000 of public money.
Thank you, Representative Myra. Did you have any testifiers you brought with you today?
I did not bring any testifiers, okay. But I understand there are individuals who would like to speak in favor of the bill.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? If so, please come forward. Or not. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Rick Heller. Thank you also, members. I currently unofficially represent the twice exceptional and disabled learners in Minnesota. I will speak in favor of a transparency bill for my because it appears even my own mom has asked me at least three times what actually was going on with this settlement that this pertains to, and she would like to know too as well specific reasons and as it relates to this bill. So that's about all I had to add to this far as agreement that transparency is an important component. However, I'm not sure how Chapter 13 fits into this as far as accessibility on what specifically goes on in these contractual agreements and what can be released for the public. I know until I get this in a readable format, I'll be able to get more engaged in this process. I thank you for that opportunity to speak tonight.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and move to members' questions. Questions for members. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Myra, has the local Board of Education and the
schools superintendent taking a position on your bill?
Represented the local school district representative Ansells or the school board associations?
The local school board, the local board of education.
In a specific district or?
Yes.
Okay.
The district in which this incident became a public one.
Okay, so the Burnsville School District.
Yes.
Okay. So Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have spoken to the chair of the school board, and I have given him the language. When we chatted on Sunday afternoon, he seemed in favor of it. He wants transparency. However, he doesn't want to go beyond what the law will allow.
Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Myra, you don't have a school board resolution of support or an official pronouncement by the board that they feel that it's in the best interests of the citizens, the taxpayers of the Burnsville district, that they know exactly what the details were of this incident, and therefore they're supporting the bill. You have nothing official.
Representative
Myra. I have not requested anything like that, and just to be perfectly clear, this would be effective on the day of enactment, and I don't believe this would be grandfathered in.
Okay.
Representative Ansell? Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Quam and then Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Myra, with the current statutes and just a background, what employees, public employees, have this type of disclosure, and after this bill was enacted, is it just a very narrow group that would come under it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Myra or Ms. Larson, if we want to. It's up to you, Representative Myra. Ms. Larson, did you? Oh, Representative Myra. Ms. Larson.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Myra.
Representative Quam, my understanding is that it is going back to the previous page of the bill. It would include, it would be all government employees, looking at line 1.9 and 1.10. Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, am I correct in that?
Ms. Larson is not, let the record show that Ms. Larson is nodding her head in an affirmative fashion to disclose that is the correct answer. Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the clarification I was looking for.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart, and then Daphne, as long as Representative Daphne doesn't make a comment about the color of my shirt today. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to make a comment on the color of my shirt?
It was an inside joke, Representative Reinhart.
All right.
Representative Daphne made a comment about me last year, and I was so scarred by it. This is the first time I've wore this shirt. Almost a year. So, Representative Briner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Myra, I'm wondering if this language has been reviewed by legal expertise, and I know we have staff with that expertise, but my question is specifically around employment law. Are there any unintended consequences that could result here in terms of public-private data in relation to employee contracts?
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have spoken with Representative Scott and also the Civil Law Committee Administrator, and I think we will probably have an amendment in Civil Law to tweak some of the wording and make it flow better, but it didn't seem that they were opposed to it, but I haven't had any other legal counsel look at it.
Representative Briner? Representative Daphne? And here it comes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a question for you about the tie. Yeah. There's been a couple of us talking. Right. In all seriousness, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Why start now? I appreciate Representative Myra bringing, the bill and the issue forward. Do you, Mr. Chair, intend on exploring this issue of severance agreements and data privacy and content of severance agreements and the like, explore it any further in this committee this year?
Representative Daphne, the motion as it stands right now is to send this bill to the Civil Law Committee. Mm-hmm. So this is something that pertaining to the sort of the non-finance provisions of this committee, that's where I would envision the conversations on data privacy and data practices taking place, not in this committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to draw some attention. Burnsville has gotten a fair amount of, the Burnsville School District has gotten a fair amount of well-deserved attention in this last week or so. What hasn't, didn't get the same amount of attention is the St. Paul Conservatory for the Performing Arts. They had what was reportedly in Dr. Tofty, the highest paid charter school administrator in the state. His last year of employment, actually, which is this year, although he's not working there anymore, $127,000 salary. According to media reports, which is, while I do have documents from the conservatory, the more interesting stuff is the stuff in the media, not the stuff that they talk about. He was placed on leave for the last 8 months of the school year, paid leave. And then this past summer, the charter school board reached a severance agreement that included an additional 1 year's salary, again, $127,000, and a letter of recommendation. So $200,000 in round numbers for not doing anything. Or actually, apparently doing something. I'd like to know what, because if I got $200,000 for doing it, you know, it'd be an interesting question. But I'm concerned, and Mr. Chair, the reason I asked, were you planning on exploring this any further? We seem to have two standards of attention being given. A charter school with less public accountability pays out $200,000 and provides a letter of reference to an employee who did something that required a suspension. A public school district pays out a little over $250,000 to an employee that may not have done anything wrong. Again, just going on the public media reports, she may not have erred in the carrying out of her responsibilities, but we're not seeing the same level of attention, or maybe more importantly, the same level of transparency and public accountability that's being demanded, rightfully, of the Burnsville Egan Savage School District. I think $200,000 for doing something that you apparently weren't supposed to do, from what I can tell from the media reports, of public money, and I really do have to come back to, in both these cases, a letter of recommendation. If I did something that caused me to be suspended from my job, why would they give me a letter of recommendation? So I needed to bring forward that there's ample reason for concern and action on this issue. There just seems to be differential levels of public attention and accountability, and that's my concern, and hopefully the concern of other members of this committee.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, and just to be clear, and I could be correct if I'm wrong, Representative Myra, your bill applies to charter schools, doesn't it?
That's my understanding. Yes, sir.
So the representative, this is for public employees, Representative Dabney, so it's not the situation you're highlighting allows for transparency in both situations.
But, Mr. Chair, I am aware that it applies to charters, and I'm pleased with that. I would have had a different speech if it didn't.
Thank you.
And maybe an amendment. But I do think that there still is different levels of transparency and accountability, and yet they're both public schools. And that's my concern. Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Myra, any closing comments?
I would appreciate your support in adding clarity for this transparency. Thank you very much.
With that, Representative Myra renews her motion to have House File 2647 recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Myra. Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes from February 29th. Any discussion, corrections, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2651, the Loon Bill. It's a Loon Bill. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Loon. Representative Loon moves that House File 2651 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education Reform. Representative Loon, to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. We do have a testifier, at least one, on this topic to kind of give the committee a fuller overview. This bill would address the issue of teachers who are suspended and currently with pay when they are charged with felonies. This is a legislative proposal that has been brought up in the legislature before. It has not been enacted into law, and I think it's time that we look to addressing this. We have a disparity, if you will, among school districts and how school boards and districts are able to handle these situations. Cities of the first class currently are able to provide for suspensions without pay in these instances, but other school districts are not. And as again, I believe our testifier will provide, it provides a very uncomfortable and a difficult situation for many school districts where they've got a situation where a teacher's been charged with a felony. There's a great deal of community concern and uproar, but they are not able to provide a suspension without pay. Understanding concerns that members may have regarding teachers who are not ultimately found guilty, the school boards would be required to escrow that money. Teachers would certainly be made whole if they are found not guilty of the charge. And with that, I would like to have Ms. Grace Kelleher from MSBA come in and more fully explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kelleher. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon. I want to thank you for finding time to hear this bill today. MSBA has been a supporter of this piece of legislation since 2006. It was brought to our delegate assembly from the Mora School District. The current statutes place undue financial burdens on school districts with no chance of any reimbursement of funds in the event a teacher placed on paid leave is found to commit the offense that's resulted in termination. So basically, if a teacher is charged with a felony, school districts from around the state must place them on paid leave until the course of their criminal case has been found. This bill, with this change, which mimics the identical position that's in 41. So remember, we have continuing contract law for all the school districts in the state, and we're following school districts for the first class. Rochester, Duluth, St. Paul, and Minneapolis are in a separate section of law. This is a copycat for the provision that's in that law now, so all the school districts around the state would be painted with the same brush. We hope this outcome of this new process, which no assumption of guilt is rendered, the current process of delaying this hearing and continuing to receive pay would carry some consequences for teachers. No funds would be due an innocent teacher would be lost. They would be escrowed and paid to the teacher once the result of the felony hearing was conducted. And no school district would be forced to reward the wrongdoing in a case that a teacher is found to have committed a felony that results in termination. So presently, and I want to just highlight where the cities of the first class have this. It's 122A41 sub 12. And that it reads, if the teacher is suspended or removed after the final decision, the board may at its discretion determine the teacher's salary or compensation at the time of filing the charges. So once again, that would be the provision we would be copying. It doesn't mandate that schools must do it this way. This would be in their discretion coming forward. And keep in mind that felonies in Minnesota are a very high bar. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. We'll make sure we get testimony from everyone who's came, and then we'll have questions at the end. Representative Loon, do you have any additional testifiers as part of your presentation?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? I see none. We'll close. Oh, sorry, Jeff. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Elswiger, Education Minnesota. And I'm just going to say that we have some concerns about this bill and ask to tell you to think about unintended consequences. Because it sounds like a good bill, and I understand Representative Loon's intentions, but there are some situations that I just ask you to think about. For instance, we had a teacher whose a student was very upset with the grade that the student received, a legitimate grade, and as a result, the student placed marijuana in her briefcase. She was charged with a felony. This would impact those individuals who may be innocent, but still they're investigating. It could impact their family, their mortgage, their health insurance, all of that. However, that being said, I mean, certainly we want all kids to be safe. We want our teachers to be the highest professionals. We want if there's a criminal process, we want that to proceed. But in the instance where there are some situations that are maybe unusual, we think that this maybe says that they might be presumed guilty instead of being presumed innocent. So, I understand what Representative Loon is trying to do, but it might have some unintended consequences.
Thank you, Ms. Halswanger. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who should testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill. Representative Loon, do you want to conclude your presentation? We'll move to member questions or make any statements?
We could go ahead and move to questions, Mr. Chair.
We'll move to member questions. Any questions for members of the committee? Representative Anzils.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, your testifier indicated that should this become law, this would not be mandatory upon the Board of Education, nor and the board and the administration would have discretion. Therefore, isn't it, I mean, I think this is a pretty good idea in theory, but shouldn't this be left up to the collective bargaining agreement at the local level?
Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Representative Anzils, for the question. I think, you know, currently in statute there is no latitude for the board. It's clearly defined that it must be suspension with pay. And so, again, by adjusting the statute, it allows for some latitude by the board. And I think that's where it would appropriately be placed. Certainly with regards to hearings on the matter in that, there are a number of protections afforded teachers through their representation in that, and I think that would help to balance these situations as well.
Representative Anzils.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Loon, unfortunately, again, it's about pay. It's always about pay. And the raft of what I would consider punitive measures that are coming before this committee are certainly going to have a chilling effect on the profession, but that's okay. As long as you think it's okay to withhold pay from a person who is deemed at the end of the process to be innocent, then I guess you can, you know, with confidence support this kind of thing. I find it a little troubling.
Representative Loon, you care to respond?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I understand that, you know, there can be situations that may give members pause. But, again, I don't think this is not an issue just about pay, in my opinion. I think this is really also about public trust. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have a wonderful intern right now, and I had her doing a little research for me. And one of the things she turned up was that there was a Supreme Court case, and I don't know the date of when it was, Gilbert versus Homar. And it was not a case involving teachers. Actually, I believe they were referencing police officers. But it was talking about a suspension without pay for someone charged with a felony. And the court ruled that, quote, the state has a significant interest in immediately suspending employees charged with felonies who occupy positions of public trust and visibility. And again, the reference was to such as police officers. But I think it could apply to teachers as well. While this interest could have been accommodated by suspending respondent with pay, the Constitution does not require the government to give an employee charged with a felony paid leave at taxpayer expense. And that's sort of the point I'm trying to make here. We're trying to provide provisions so that anyone innocent is receives everything they're due. But again, if that person is proven guilty, there is no mechanism for obtaining those funds that were provided to someone who was charged and guilty of a felony. And again, in looking at a couple of cases, I just Googled, Minnesota teachers charged with felonies last night to see what's going on. And I don't want to mention any specific cases. These are sensitive cases and situations in communities where they're going on. But in most cases, it's some kind of criminal sexual conduct with students. And again, I think this is a question we need to wrestle with, A, from that standpoint, what is reasonable for the boards to be able to consider doing in those situations, and B, the fact that we have a disparate situation for different school districts. School districts and cities of the first class have the ability to do this. My school board, your school board, does not.
Representative Anderson, then Erickson. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a question here, and I just tried to get counsel, and we couldn't come up with it. Anyway, line 2.6, we're talking about a felony charge. The bar is set quite high. And on line 2.10, we're talking about does not result in a penalty. And my question is, could a felony be plea bargained down to a gross misdemeanor, and being that word just says penalty, would that still apply in this case? Should that not say felony conviction instead of penalty on line 2.10?
We can go to Representative Loon or Ms. Larson in that matter. As we read the statute right now, Ms. Larson, do you have any advice for us on how it would read and how the item Representative Anderson has brought up would change or not change things?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think the application of page 2, line 10 is intended to affect more than just what happens with the court, because it's also talking about the decision of the school board as well as the arbitrator, and there may be other kinds of penalties that the board or the arbitrator would deem appropriate with assuming, for example, that the charge is not continued. But there would be behavior that would merit a penalty of some kind from the board.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But then again, my question is, would that result in pay being withheld if the charge was something other than a felony?
Ms. Larson, can you follow up on that?
Mr. Chairman, members, the trigger for being able to withhold the pay, as this has been written, is the charge of a felony. But in terms of payment of salary or compensation, that depends upon the outcome of all of the proceedings, not the fact that a felony was charged.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, first of all, we need to remember that Representative Loon's proposal mirrors that of cities of the first class, and I would think we would want all our professionals to be under the same provision when it comes to this kind of behavior that might result in a felony charge. But I was wondering, Mr. Chair, and maybe counsel can help, what happens in other professions? And counsel is indicating she doesn't know. So I guess maybe I need to do further homework on that. So that, Mr. Chair, I will do.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Peterson.
This comes to my committee.
Pass. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Myra, if you know, I'm wondering when the cities of the first class got their law in this category. I'm always just generally irked that we have two sets of laws for the school districts. But I wondered when did they enact their law, and I wonder why it wasn't enacted for all schools at that time.
I believe Representative Greiling meant Representative Loon, not Representative Myra, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so Representative Loon, I'm assuming we'll go to staff on 122.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would not want to trust my recollection on that.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Coe, or Ms. Larson, can we look that up and maybe get an answer in the next 30 seconds? No? Well, when there's an answer, if we can maybe share that with the entire committee, Representative Greiling, is that okay? Staff, thank you. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Anzell's asked an interesting question and framed it as if you're okay withholding pay from someone who's actually innocent in the end, then you'd be okay voting for this bill. But I guess I'd be more concerned about asking that in reverse. If you're okay giving full pay to someone who sexually assaulted a young student and in the end is convicted of it, if you're okay giving them their full pay throughout that time period, I guess you're okay opposing this bill. But it's my understanding that if they are actually not convicted and they're innocent, Representative Loon, they get their full pay. Is that correct?
Representative Loon.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Anzels.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, perhaps you should give some thought to the fact that this may take months to adjudicate. And, you know, we get to come here and a nice warm building in January and walk around here like we're big shots, and that classroom teacher may not be able to survive a paycheck without serious financial harm to the family. This has all to do about the ability for one to sustain themselves while a matter is being adjudicated. And that's my only intent here, that the employer and the process and the system could drag this out for months only to find that that teacher is innocent, and only to find out that during that several months of being without pay, harm is done to the family. That's my only point.
Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, the issue raised by Representative Anderson raised concerns for me that I didn't have when I originally read this bill, and I'm wondering if either Ms. Kelleher or legal counsel for MSBA would speak to that issue. I think the difference between a felony conviction and any penalty that might be incurred in the course of a hearing is quite extreme when we're talking about withholding someone's pay for months and maybe years. So I just wonder if someone could offer a more refined legal opinion about that consequence.
We can start with Ms. Larson. Did you hear?
That's
okay. Representative Bryan, do you want to restate the question for Ms. Larson, and then if Ms. Kelleher wishes to come down, she may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think Ms. Larson, her opinion is what raised the question for me, and that is she did differentiate between a felony conviction and any penalty that might be offered, and said the legislation as worded did not require a felony conviction in order to have teacher's salary withheld in a final way. Any type of penalty could result in that. And I think Representative Anderson drew attention to that in a way that makes that a bit disconcerting for me, because that whatever penalty might result is totally undefined in the context of how it may or may not relate to a felony charge. And I think that's really problematic legally. And so if this is the same language that exists for cities of the first class, then I'd like to know a little bit more about how that's actually played out before I could give my support to that broad of a consequence.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, the language that appears on page 2 really has two parts to it. One is, what is the trigger for being able to withhold pay? The trigger is the teacher is charged with a felony and the underlying conduct that is the subject of the charge is a ground for proposed immediate discharge. Well, that is one aspect of it, but another aspect is that there is a hearing that will be held, that the board may have a hearing, the arbitrator may have a hearing, and even if there is not a conviction, there may be conduct that will lead to some sort of penalty short of a conviction for a felony.
Ms. Representative Reinhart, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's exactly my point. Does that not give us pause for the difference? We're not talking about a felony conviction affirming the pay, that the right of the board to have withheld the pay and therefore keep it. We're talking about any penalty that might be incurred. So, and that is the opinion that Ms. Larson has offered. So I'm asking if there's other legal expertise in the room. I'm very uncomfortable with the breadth of the second definition of penalty.
Right, I just want to correct something. You said any, and I don't think that's not how I read the language. It does not result in a penalty to or suspension, termination, or discharge of a teacher, which would be different than any. But Ms. Larson or Representative Loon, did you wish to respond to that?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I think the question would be, how is this operated in cities of the first class since it's been the same language? And I'm not aware of any specific instances where someone's been, again, charged with a felony and maybe it's been, you know, reduced down to a lesser charge, but perhaps Ms. Alzweiger or someone else has direct information on that topic.
So the hypothetical the committee is discussing right now is an individual is charged with a felony and the school district ultimately decides to terminate or suspend that employee, and the disagreement is over whether they should be receiving back pay in that hypothetical. Representative Brennan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, from my reading of this, it doesn't require a termination or suspension. It says does not result in a penalty to or suspension, termination, or discharge. So there could be another undefined penalty incurred that doesn't result in discharge, but still could result in that pay not being reimbursed.
Ms. Alzweiger, you're back up for a second crack.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I won't say that I am the ultimate legal advice here, but I believe the conversation here is very important, because it says that they must reimburse the teacher for any salary or compensation withheld if the final decision of the board or the arbitrator does not result in a penalty to or suspension, termination, or discharge. What would it be if it was determined that they received a letter of reprimand? That is not, some might argue that that's not a penalty. It certainly isn't a suspension, termination, or discharge. But the teacher could be withheld salary and compensation. And then according, you know, even the salary and compensation, there's a lot more to think about. Salary and compensation, I would guess, one would think of as normally is the money that you receive in your paycheck. But there's also the benefits and the health insurance that somebody would have to pay. There's also possibly, if it's a year or 6 months, and they're found to be, you know, not guilty, that they will lose a year of TRA service credit. That's employer contributions, the employee contributions. So it is much more complicated than it sounds.
Okay. Ms. Alzweiger, do you have alternative language for us, or are you saying that the statute should stay as it is?
Mr. Chair, I'm more than happy to go back to our attorneys and see if we could come up with some kind of language and work with Representative Loon with the intent.
The intent of this, we are moving this bill to the Education Reform Committee, so Representative Loon, is that something that you're willing to do to continue working on this?
Yes, I'd be happy to look at this. And again, I would be more, I would be interested in speaking with the cities of the first class as well to see if this has been an issue, because there's been a number of instances where teachers have been suspended without pay in those districts.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think this was not a question of mine originally, but now it is. And, you know, not being a police officer or an attorney, what is the level of evidence or variables that lead to a charge of a person? Because if someone would say, as Ms. Alzweiger brought up, that Mr. Teacher has marijuana in his bag. Is that enough to charge him? Don't you have to find it? I mean, what level has to be met to charge someone?
Well, my half a semester of law school tells me that the premise of an arrest is probable cause. And that is so that's the legal standard for an arrest. Whether that is charged at a felony level, we don't have the public safety committee here. We do have the former CA of the public safety committee here, but that standard is going to be higher than that. Right. So somewhere between probable cause and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But I seem to recall now that there is an escalating standard from. So it is. There is a higher standard there, Representative Bills.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps. And then I also think, and Representative Anzels and Representative Kelly both bring up good points. Is that, but you have to see the unintended consequences the other way too. Is that someone, I think, with no moral compass, who would actually abuse a child, might also have the lack of moral compass to stretch out a procedure when they're getting their pay. So that's the other side. I understand that what Ms. Allswiger brought up with a teacher who was railroaded or something was planted on them. But you have to also see that person who lacks that type of character could also, in an unintended consequence, work that system for some type of pay or payout.
So. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Allswiger's not at the table anymore, but because this is coming to the Policy Committee, I wanted to make sure that she visits with me about the concerning phrases at the same time she visits, or in alignment with visiting with Representative Loon. So we have these. If there are any changes to be made, we have those arranged before we have the next hearing.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, we have another testifier who has indicated he could perhaps shed some light on these statutes. He's very familiar with them, and the cities of the first class statute. So,
welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Roger Arnson. I'm attorney for the secondary principals and the elementary principals associations, and we're in these statutes. And I've litigated several cases under both the cities of the first class statute and the regular statute. And a couple of these things, before you get too far afield, I think are important to know. Representative Anzell's question about can you do these rules in bargaining, you can't. You can't change these statutes in the collective bargaining process. These are purely statutory proceedings. If you negotiated something that was different than was in any of these statutes, it'd be void under Pelro, which says any agreement in a collective bargaining agreement that's contrary to law is void. So these rules are direct grants of rights to individuals outside of collective bargaining in the teacher area.
So, Mr. Aronson, just to be clear,
yes,
in state law, outside of cities of the first class right now, we mandate that school districts pay those who are charged with felonies individually and ultimately convicted. We mandate that in state law right now.
Mr. Chair, with one caveat, if the individual is proposed for discharge by the school district and demands a hearing, then that statement is true. But if the person just resigned or right, whatever, then no. But it is during the hearing process. And so with that caveat, the answer to your question is yes.
Unbelievable. Mr. Aronson, please continue.
What this statute says and what Representative Loon is trying to do here in the second sentence that's driving you a little bit sets a high bar in the event that the board must do the reimbursement. The money that she's setting aside here pending the hearing, if you are completely exonerated in the school district matter, then it's a mandatory payback. If you're not, the way I would read this is, it's up to the arbitrator to decide. And if when you read the end of the sentence, you kind of lose track of, the front of this says, they're going to propose you for discharge. You have 10 days to demand a hearing. And then at the end of the hearing, the arbitrator has jurisdiction to award back pay, impose some suspension, whatever the case may be. But if the arbitrator said there's no cause for any discipline here, in other words, no cause for any suspension, termination, or discharge, then it is mandatory that the board would have to pay the back pay. I think it's that straightforward.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Any additional questions for members of the committee? Representative Kloon, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank the committee and just, you know, publicly state, you know, again to Ms. Allswager and that, you know, if there's additional things she wants to continue to talk with me about, I would be happy to and talk with Chair Erickson because this bill is going to be heard in her committee as well.
With that, Representative Loon renews her motion to have House File 2651 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education Reform. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Loon. Members, the final item on our agenda today is an informational hearing on House File 1870, the Peterson Bill. Representative Peterson, while this bill is not before this committee, it's an informational hearing to make sure that members of the Education Finance Committee are familiar with its subject matter and jurisdiction. So we have a list of members of the public who wish to testify. May I move to that and proceed with your testimony later?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The first item I have on the list is from the North Side, first testifier from the North Side Achievement Zone, Sandra Samuels. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Sandra Samuels. And thank you, Chair, sir, and committee members. Wonderful to be here today. It's actually very exciting. I am speaking today on behalf as president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone, as a member of the African American Leadership Forum, and as a board member of MNCAN, and most importantly, as a mother of three girls, raising them in North Minneapolis, where we have arguably some of the worst performing schools. And today I am coming in support of Representative Peterson's bill to end LIFO. And I do so for a number of reasons. And really, I feel like there is nothing better that we can do for our children right now. And I say that because right now in Minnesota, we are confronted with some enormous opportunity as well as responsibility. You probably have heard that the north side of Minneapolis received a federal promise neighborhood grant of $28 million at the end of last year. And a promise neighborhood is a neighborhood where the adults in the community make a promise to our children that at the center they will have great schools surrounded by strong family and community support. And for the last 3 years, we've been working with families as the first teachers to make sure they're engaged, providing whole family wraparound support for them, but also in a robust relationship with the schools. And so that's $28 million from the federal government, believing that we can transform lives of low-income inner-city children in North Minneapolis. And then there was the Race to the Top grant, the Early Learning Challenge that Minnesota also won, which was $45 million. And the Northside Achievement Zone was one neighborhood that they selected to also do work around early learning. And then, of course, there's the I-3 grant, $17 million, also given to Minnesota, focused on K-3. You know, when one of the Minnesota Department of Education representatives talked to a Department of Education rep and said, wow, you know, Minnesota got these three grants in such a short amount of time to transform education for its children. How has it worked in other states where you've had three such incredible grants? And the Department of Education representative for the United States just looked flatly and said, well, we've never done this before. And we're looking to Minnesota to see what you're going to do with the federal support that you've gotten to leverage the dollars. And so great opportunity, but a lot of responsibility. You know, within the African American Leadership Forum, we talk about that the achievement gap, which, of course, we all know Minnesota has the dubious distinction of having the highest, depending on what area you're measuring, that the achievement gap is made up of five gaps. The preparation gap, you know, kids not being ready for kindergarten. The time gap, if a child is that far behind in school, they need more time to catch up. A leadership gap, we need strong principals in all of our schools. A belief gap. And most importantly, a teaching gap. We know that the number one variable, school-based variable, for how a child does in school is the quality of his or her teacher. And all the research shows that. I mean, I don't think we're arguing about research today. We might be arguing about politics, but we're not arguing about research. And so in the zone and throughout the state, what we're asking is that the government believes in Minnesota's ability to transform education. We as a community believe in our ability together to transform education. And I'm here today asking you on a policy level to believe. And when you believe, you act differently. And you end something as antiquated as a LIFO. Because what we're trying to do is not get rid of teachers. We're trying to protect the best teachers. And, you know, I have a map, and I'm sure you've all have seen the new Teacher Project report that came out in 2010 that really looked at quality blind layoffs, really the case against that, that you cannot protect your best teachers when you do that. And this map shows the states in red, I call them the remaining dinosaurs, sorry, you know, that still use LIFO, still use seniority as the only measure of when laying off teachers, that it is against the law to take quality evaluations or anything else into consideration. And so we're not talking about ending seniority or not considering it, but not letting that be the number one factor, because all the research says that that is crazy. And so I want to conclude by saying, again, this is about keeping our best teachers in the classroom. When you have a seniority-based system that dictates who you let off, you are going to lose some of your best teachers. And so one thing that we do in the zone is we have something called Family Academy. It's a 12-week parenting education program, and the families that come through that program do not go to Minneapolis Early Childhood Program. 75% of them make $10,000 or less, and they learn all about brain development, positive discipline, the importance of your child being ready for kindergarten, word count. But, you know, they learn to believe that a community is surrounding them to change the trajectory for their children. In fact, a mother cried at one of our last graduations and said, "I am finally starting to believe that my child is worthy of college." And while the parents graduate, the babies also graduate, because it's a program for parents with children 0 to 3. And we give all the babies in the program a t-shirt that says college graduate. And then on the back, we have the year that they're going to graduate college. And our youngest baby right now is 2036. And the belief gap is the biggest gap, I think, confronting our state, our communities, our schools, our policy making. Because when you believe, you act differently. And what I'm asking today is that you leverage the resources that the federal government has given us, that you listen to the voices of the African-American community, of inner-city communities, of communities throughout the state, and you believe, too, that these babies can and will graduate from college. But we've got to do everything to make that happen. And by ending LIFO, I think that will show that we really do believe it's possible, because we've got to do everything to make it happen, whatever it takes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Jennifer Flood. Is there Jennifer Flood here? And on deck is Ann Kay. So if whoever's on deck, if you want to come down so we can... Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thanks.
Even though I just did.
Jennifer Flood. I can do it again. Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Jennifer Flood, yet a third time. And thank you for the opportunity to be here and speak in support of House File 1870 and the importance of keeping the best teachers in the classroom. I'm here as a parent. I'm a parent of three children. They're ages 3, 5, and 7, and our oldest is a second grader in St. Paul Public Schools. I'm also a former public school teacher, and I'm a lifelong progressive Democrat. So it's been really interesting to talk with friends about why I'm supporting this bill and why I think we really need bipartisan support of this and to get it passed based on the experience I'm going to share with you. Basically, we moved to the Twin Cities several years ago, and my husband and I prioritized, as many parents do, buying a home where we wanted to send our kids to school. And we've been very grateful that our daughter has had excellent teachers the last 3 years. And we were really quite devastated last spring when we discovered that our daughter's teacher in first grade would be let go for the following year because she was the one with the least seniority at the school. And I think what was most astonishing about this, not just for my family, but for the many parents who, as this happened, we all kind of rallied around her and said, you know, we need to go to the principal and figure out how we can change this because everybody knows you're an excellent teacher. The staff recognizes that you're excellent. The kids recognize you're excellent. And many of us who have been volunteers in the classroom had seen that over the course of the year, she had taken this group of students, which was extremely diverse in terms of languages spoken at home and what kids were coming to school with at the beginning of the year. You know, some couldn't read at all at the beginning of the year, didn't know the alphabet, and then others came in reading at a third grade level. And she'd taken this extraordinary span within this class and made sure that every single child by the end of the year was reading on grade level. She was extraordinary in her ability to also engage with parents and I think enable all parents to feel comfortable coming into the classroom and figuring out how they could best support their children's learning at home. So truly on every single level, we all felt as parents that she had done an extraordinary job and we just couldn't imagine that there wasn't some way to keep her at our school. And so we went to the principal, and the principal was basically like, there's really nothing I can do about it. This is the law. And then we also went to the district and said, well, we understand. We had 30 of us emailed the union president at the time and said, we understand that there's this law, and it's a little bit different for, you know, what happens in St. Paul, as you all have been discussing these cities of the first class. And so we understand that something could be done differently in St. Paul. And what we heard from the district was, well, actually, the state's probably going to take that up, so we're not going to do anything with that. And we're like, well, when is this going to change? Because we're trying to save this teacher, and we have young children that are coming up in the system, and we don't want to lose more great teachers at our school. And what we heard was, well, you know, there's a new teacher evaluation system coming into play, and it's just going to take some time. And we're like, well, what is time? Like, is that like a year? Is that 2 years? We're like, well, it's going to take quite a few years. Like maybe when your kids are in middle school. And I think for those of us that have, you know, like I said, my kids are 3, 5, and 7, and many of us have very young children, we thought, so you're basically telling us that for the entire time that our children are going to be in elementary school, there is nothing that we can do to keep great teachers at this school. And I think it was a very disheartening moment and experience for many of us as parents who we deeply support or we believe in public education. We, you know, really want to support our teachers, and we feel like we, in particular for the teachers that work so hard, like I said, in our school, which has a diverse student population, and I think it takes so much extra work, it just felt horrible that we're not able to actually recognize that work and say, yes, you're doing an incredible job, we can keep you. So I'm here basically to ask you that to change this outdated system of LIFO, of releasing teacher or only honoring teacher's number of years in the classroom, and to actually honor performance as well, because I think as a parent, that's what many of us need to hear, to know that we are making the right choices in terms of where we send our kids. There's nothing worse than feeling like you're not doing the best thing for your kids. And I think it had a very destabilizing effect on our school community last year, and there were some parents that actually ultimately chose to send their kids to the local private school instead because they felt like at least there that there's a recognition of, you know, who's doing a great job and making sure that those people can stay on and continue to build the school community. So basically, I'm just asking you to value performance and to end the seniority-based layoffs now. Please don't make me wait till my kids are in middle school, because we can't afford to wait. We need this to happen this year. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Ann Kay, and next on deck is Ben Arndt. And after that, Linnell Mickelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Education Finance Chair, Mr. Garfalo, and members. My name is Ann Kay, and as a member of Student First, a national movement to transform public education, I urge you to support HF 1870. This bill puts forth needed reforms for Minnesota's public education system. It puts the needs of students at the forefront of the conversation. For far too long, we have been standing by a system that protects adult interests at the cost of student achievement. This bill is not about job security or due process rights. Rather, it is about structuring our public education system so student achievement is the number one objective, and so that effective educators are able to thrive in a system that promotes this common goal. As a former elementary and junior high music teacher and current educational consultant and college adjunct instructor and parent of older ones, I support creating a responsive educational system that values subject expertise, evaluation, and seniority. I'm pleased that Minnesota now has a law that requires evaluation and that a state evaluation is being developed. Sadly, I know teachers who have taught for decades without any feedback or evaluation. Every person needs feedback to enable them to grow. I know districts where the teachers with the most seniority get the most desirable jobs, regardless of evaluation. This is especially unfair to struggling learners who need the absolute best teachers, but they get the leftovers. Students at the bottom of Minnesota's vast achievement gap deserve more. This is not a responsive system. So now, it's a natural step, next step, to pass legislation to ensure that teacher evaluation will be a factor in times of layoffs and teacher absences. If teachers want to be valued as the professionals that we are, we should realize that what is assessed or evaluated is what is valued, and what is valued is what is funded. Once a new responsive system is in place, I believe that citizens will value education more, and in turn, they will vote to increase educational funding. But first, we must build a new system. We must make sure that students have quality teachers. By requiring districts to use evaluation tools to assess teachers and principals based on multiple measures, including student growth, we are recognizing and rewarding great teachers. All teachers and principals are not the same. Some are better than others. They should not be treated like interchangeable pieces or widgets that we move around or they go from district to district. Those who strive for and achieve excellence for their students should be recognized and rewarded accordingly. As the system stands now, performance is not a consideration in school layoff policies. Rather, seniority trumps all. We cannot let that outdated last-in, first-out policy dictate our school district's layoff practices. Under that system, our children stand to lose some of our best teachers. So I understand this bill is hard to push through, and I'm really hoping for bipartisan support. I know that you know this needs to be done, but I believe it is the right thing to do. We must make the hard choices. We must put our students first at the forefront of every conversation and every policy decision. This bill is a step in that direction. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Ben Arndt and then Linnell Mickelson. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Benjamin Arndt. And I am a member of Students for Education Reform. I'm currently a freshman at the University of Minnesota and pursuing a career in high school education. As a potential future educator and most recent benefactor of the K-12 teachers, performance being taken into consideration as a factor for layoffs is something that I consider necessary. In my last year of school, a brilliant young woman teaching English was neglected the extension of her contract due simply to the fact that positions were already filled by less effective, more senior teachers. Not only was she able to engage all the students in her remarkably diverse classroom, as well as ESL students, but also the high-performing students as well, despite her abilities, which were far and above certain ineffective teachers, she was let go first. The lack of performance consideration is a present and has been an ongoing problem. Looking to become a teacher myself, there is no greater cause of apprehension than my job being at risk for the sole reason of my youth. Like almost all teachers, I will have an education specified very directly to a certain career, and with so little job security, this is a daunting perspective and a hard choice to make. This bill will give up-and-coming teachers like myself opportunities we need without putting the teachers' schools need at any risk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Linnell Mickelson? And if there's any other members of the public who wish to testify, please just form a queue or sit behind there or just start coming down. So Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Lynnell Michelson. I come here today as a person who has been a parent in Minneapolis Public Schools for 17 years, and I'm also the co-founder of a group called Put Kids First Minneapolis. We are a completely voluntary, grassroots group of parents and citizens who are pushing for teacher and principal contract reform in Minneapolis, including the end of last in, first out. So I'm here speaking both as a parent and as a lifelong DFLer, as are most of the people in my coalition. You know, I come to this issue because starting in 2001, Minneapolis lost 28% of its student enrollment, and that went on for the next 10 years. That 28% was lost, you know, just it's kind of interesting, about one-third was due to the baby boomlet being done, but the other two-thirds was mostly people voting with their feet and either going to suburban schools or charter schools or private schools, but mostly suburban and charter and mostly from the north side. When 28% of your students go in 10 years, we also lost 1,300 of our teaching positions. So I can say that parents in Minneapolis, more than probably anywhere else in the state, know exactly what last in, first out looks like. And as I've said in previous testimony, it's like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre came to our school every single spring and ground up some of our best and brightest and most talented teachers. We lost, in terms of raw numbers, we lost half of our teachers of color. This is in a district where 70% of our students are teachers of color and 85% of our teachers are white. We lost half our teachers of color under last in, first out. We lost teachers of the year. We just lost and lost and lost. Now, if they had been replaced by fabulous teachers, I wouldn't even be here. But they weren't. They were almost always replaced by far more mediocre teachers. And the loss of human potential and talent was just jaw-dropping. It was just jaw-dropping. And I've noticed, this is my third time I've been up here testifying, I just have to say, I'm noting that I have just not seen a parade of ordinary parents coming here and begging you to make seniority, not effectiveness, to keep seniority, not effectiveness, the criteria for their children's teachers. Haven't seen it. And that should tell you something. Now, I have an op-ed in the Strib coming out tomorrow on this very subject, and I am making the argument, and now I'm going to switch to politics, because I know it's all policy here, but let's just pretend. And politically, and I'm coming from a lifelong DFLer, progressive, union member, the whole nine yards, but I would say politically, last in, first out is to Democrats what gay marriage is to Republicans. Now, stick with me, people. I'm saying that... that Republicans can keep, you guys can keep banging on your Bibles and saying that marriage is between a man and a woman, but you've basically lost that culture war. You've lost it, and you've especially lost it with people under 30. And the longer you cling to it, the more bigoted and stupid you look. Okay, now back to Democrats. We can keep saying that, you know, last in, first out is that it's just a wonderful policy. I'm sorry. A wonderful policy.
And then we move on.
Yeah. And that we can't tell who's a good teacher or a bad teacher, blah, 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 blah. But we have lost that argument with the public. Mincan's going to step up here and give the results of that poll, but we have lost that argument in the public, my fellow Democrats. And the longer we stick to it, the dumber we look. So as a Democrat, I'm just telling you, every time we vote against this stuff, we are telling ordinary voters in my neighborhood and in Sandra Samuel's neighborhood and all over the state that if we have to choose between a kid's right to a great teacher and an ineffective teacher's right to a job, we in the DFL will side with that ineffective teacher. And as someone who would like to retake control of the House and the Senate next fall, I don't think that's a winning campaign promise. I just don't see it. I don't see it, the PR value. So you can help me with that. And I also really say this goes against so many...
Why am I still letting you talk?
I don't know.
It's like my right hand is paralyzed. I can't grab the gavel. Please proceed with your testimony.
I'm almost done. Yeah, the reason why I'm here as a Democrat is this actually goes against so many core principles that I have as a DFLer. It goes against my desire for the best education possible for these kids, for right use of taxpayer dollars, for racial equity, for social justice, for so many things. So I think this is a clean bill. I don't see any tricks or, you know, ponies in it. And I really think that there's so few things that are come out of this session that can truly be bipartisan, that people can get behind. So I'm really urging you for the sake of the best, for the 800,000 school kids in this state, and for much more, please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. thank you for coming to the committee, and as always, we appreciate the public taking the time to come down and share their thoughts. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Fred Daly from Rochester, and I was on the Rochester School Board for 8 years, from 2002 through 2010. And one of the first things we got into when I got on the board was teacher negotiations. And we sat down in their conference room, and we laid out how many dollars we had, because we've got to stay within our budget. And we found we could give about a 2% raise over the each year for the next 2 years. Well, we turns out that the people we were negotiating with were thinking 10% a year was about right. Well, we negotiated, and we ended up giving about 4% a year for 2 years. And then I said, how are we going to do that? We don't have the money in the budget. And I was told, don't worry about it. The system settles things out. And sure enough, it came up to the legislature, and the legislature filled in the hole. Thank you. So then, next contract, same thing. We ended up offering our teachers twice what we could afford to offer them. Legislature came through and filled it in. And then Margaret Thatcher's words came in, because suddenly the government was running out of money. The next negotiation, we were $10 million short, and we couldn't do that anymore. The previous 2 years, we were able to just lay off probationary teachers and then call them back in the fall, and it was all just a nice little buddy system. This time, we laid off all the probationary teachers, and we still needed more money, so we had to start cutting programs. And we cut programs, and all the teachers in the program got cut. And then all summer long, there was musical chairs going on, where the senior teachers that had licensure somewhere else were bumping teachers in other areas in order to keep a job. And it was just total chaos as far as our personnel was concerned. And in the end, we got it settled, but no one was really happy. And then, at the same time, right about then, we realized that our students were failing the state tests at the 25% in reading and 50% in math. And so we hired a superintendent and gave him the job of closing the achievement gap. And as part of that, he came in, and he was very systematic, and he was able to tie every student to every class, to their grades, and also the history of how they'd done. And one of the things we found out is, when you did that, you just also tied it to teachers. And we could look at it, and we could see, well, there are certain teachers that when kids are in their class, they don't advance. But by law, we could not say a word about it. It's really sad, because after 3 years, the superintendent left, the school board left, and the teachers that weren't performing are still on the job. We can do better.
Thank you for your testimony. And sir, could you, any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Valerie Barr. I'm the founding executive director for MinCAN, the Minnesota Campaign for Achievement Now. Thank you for allowing me to speak in support of this bill. last month, our organization released a comprehensive survey, and I wanted to just make sure that we reinforce those numbers here in front of this committee. And I wanted to thank all of you for your leadership and the governor for his commitment to education and passing their first statewide teacher evaluation system last year, and for Representative Peterson and his leadership in bringing this conversation to the next level. So first, two things that we, amongst other elements, but two things in particular that I wanted to highlight for all of you today from our poll. First, Minnesotans agree on how to measure teacher performance. So 80% think that student test scores are important when evaluating teacher performance. 84% think evaluations of the teacher conducted by the principal are important when evaluating teacher performance. And 97% of respondents consider student learning progress important in determining a teacher's performance. Again, that's 97%. So many, many people speaking in unified voice. And the second element that I think is pertinent and important for this conversation in particular is that Minnesotans also want to make sure that teacher layoffs are based on performance. And so 96% believe that student learning progress should be an important factor in determining which teachers are laid off first. And in fact, among five factors when we ask this particular question, Minnesotans overall put student learning progress in the first place and years of experience in fourth place. And if teacher layoffs are required, most respondents, being 91%, believe that seniority should be considered, but that the primary factor should be teacher performance. And we couldn't agree more. And moreover, a clear majority of respondents, 79%, believe that laying off teachers based primarily on seniority hurts the quality of education for our students. And so, again, part of our job as an organization is to make sure that we listen to the voices of the people here in Minnesota and to make sure that you hear what they're saying as well. And as you can see here, 1,000 Minnesotans from across the political spectrum, from Republicans to Democrats to Independents, are speaking. And we want to make sure that you are listening to them. So thank you.
Thank you. And I believe you've shared that poll with the legislature, or did I just get it? I don't remember.
Yes, we shared it with everyone, so everyone should have gotten it, and we are happy to reshare that if necessary.
That might be a good piece of information. Thank you very much for your testimony and for your work. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members, Mary Ciccone, Parents United for Public Schools. We are here supporting this bill, and we hope that it moves forward, that there's an opportunity, because its effectiveness date is 2016, to, in a final negotiation, to have a way to vet or audit the evaluation process that will be used. Current law allows for 341 different evaluation processes, and we believe that if parents are truly going to say, I know my schools have quality teachers, that they also know that the evaluation process being used in their district is indeed finding and identifying a quality teacher, not just a teacher who moves kids on MCAs. So we're very supportive, and we hope that in the time between now and the effectiveness date that we do audit the evaluation processes.
Any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concern? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jim Barnhill. I'm recording secretary for the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, Local 59. I'm a special education teacher, 9th through 12th. I have students from 9th grade through the 12th grade. And I want to speak with some concerns. When in 2003, 2004, I got the dreaded pink slip myself. It had nothing to do with my effectiveness. It had to do with the fact that there were massive layoffs taking place in Minneapolis, and that was very difficult for me, extremely difficult. I was as angry as anybody else would be. But I did go out to a different school district in the western suburbs, and I was there for a year, and I became a better teacher just because I learned some things from that school district that I had not picked up yet. And I fought and fought and fought to get back into Minneapolis because I love that school district, and I think it's just a fabulous place to teach. I did everything I could to get back, and I was successful. So I know what it's like. I'm not speaking as a person who doesn't have firsthand experience with this. I surely felt at the time there was some injustice going on when I was laid off. And I honestly did not have what I believe to be the maturity to recognize that there are other people who have put in many, many years of blood, sweat, and tears into the students of Minneapolis. And as a matter of part of the social fabric that we have, that it would be just as unfair to for them to be given that pink slip if they were doing a good job in Minneapolis. So, but I want to speak specifically to the bill. I do appreciate the fact that the teacher evaluation bill is an attempt to develop the best teachers possible. That's what it should be. It should help us all get to be better teachers, to constantly develop our skills. I'm looking at the language in subdivision 10 of this bill, and it talks about the various domains that you're rated in as effective or ineffective or whatnot, and ranked in certain orders. The concern that I have comes back to a committee meeting this morning in education reform, where the discussion was what's vague, intentionally vague, and what's specific in terms of the rules that are made. And so who interprets that, and how does that get played out? So the concerns that I have had to do with the fact that if you're rated in each of the various five domains of the standards of effective teaching or the standards of effective instruction, how does it play out within the bill? Suppose I'm ranked highly in four of the five domains, but is one of those domains going to be weighted more severely or weighted more heavily than another domain? That's not clear. I don't think that it's clear in the bill. If it is, I haven't seen that. I'm concerned, too, about what kind of effect this would have on teachers who, especially in the role of special education teachers, we have to be lawyer, advocate, social worker, mother, father, teacher, guardian, and every other role in the under the sun for our students. And when that role requires us to be advocate, even sometimes in a way that might put ourselves at risk for our jobs because our employer may not like what we're having to say, I'm concerned how that could affect your evaluation. And so it to me, there's a conflict of interest almost right there, and I am worried about that. A couple years ago, I was in the position of having to highly and very forcefully advocate for students among my disabled population. And I know that people and some higher-ranking people were taking a very close look at all of my legal paperwork, and it felt like a fishing expedition to me. And I thankfully nothing happened, but I got to tell you, that's the kind of thing that I worry about in terms of the bill, the ability of a person to be capricious and somehow to rank you ineffective in a category for which you're actually doing the highest quality work that you're capable of. So the other final thing I want to talk about is how my concern is that this could be a bypass for due process. The teacher evaluation bill should be about us getting to be better teachers. I'm worried about this being used as a bypass strategy for laying people off in mass quantities and then sort of using that to cull people. And the final thing that I'm worried about, and I really, as a teacher, I think that right now the opportunity for our profession is to be as professional as we have ever been in the terms of the potential for collaboration to take place in the classroom, and for teachers to not just be silos in our own classrooms, but rather to also be really collaborating with one another. I am concerned about how this becomes so individualistic that you become so self-interested in your own preservation. That now, why do I have time for this student teacher? Why would I even consider going across the room to help this new teacher out who's doing their job? There is a certain degree to which, we're all in it for ourselves now. Let's buckle down. Let's focus on our classroom. Let's get the job done there, because God forbid that we would want to be rated as lower than the next person in the next classroom. So I'm not trying to say it's all negative or all positive. I'm trying to say that I think there are some serious reservations that I have, and that I would hope that as this moves forward, that we could find some ways to solve some of those issues. And I would also just have to say that in all the previous discussions, there is this massive, massive assumption being made that young teachers, we almost talk about it as though young teachers are by definition high quality teachers. And older teachers are, by definition, not as effective. And that is a very dangerous assumption for us to be making while we continue this on. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
Representative Slocum, I want to make sure we get all public testimony.
I'm going to be quick.
Only because I like you, Representative.
I know you do. I just want it noted in the record that Jim's incredibly brilliant, incredibly creative, and incredibly awesome daughter was in my class.
Okay. Is there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and this is twice in one day. I may be the last testifier, so I'll try to keep it quick. And I just would echo the testimony offered by others this morning, or this afternoon, Ms. Flood, Mr. Arndt, Ms. Samuels. And I think we all know the value of a quality teacher on a child's academic achievement. And the partnership supports this bill because we really think it just is common sense. As Ms. Michelson had mentioned, over a 10-year period, for whatever reasons, the Minneapolis School District had to lay off 1,000 teachers. And by going through the process in current statute, they lost any number of high-quality teachers, future teachers of the year, and they had no discretion on whether or not to keep them or let them go. And we think that Representative Peterson's bill smartly builds off of last year's teacher evaluation law and will in the future give districts the opportunity to have some discretion when they have to lay people off, that they can do so by incorporating performance. So if they have a future teacher of the year, they don't have to let them go. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other members of the public who wish to testify, Representative Peterson, do you want to make a statement before we briefly went to member questions?
I think I've made a lot of statements. I think the committee would probably appreciate questions more than hearing what I have to say anymore. So,
thank you. Any questions for members of the committee? Representative Dietrich.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having this hearing. I felt a little at loss voting on this on the floor, because it didn't come here, and I was hoping that it would come here, and I realize now why it didn't. And I realize I could do my due diligence and read the bill brief and the bill and all that type of stuff. But as you know, I'm really involved in school trust lands, and so I would love to talk to those parent groups about school trust lands if they ever have time. So anyhow, what is Representative Peterson? When people say that this is seen, what is the actual criteria that you would suggest that you review teachers on and use in laying them off?
Well, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dietrich. It's a three-part decision-making process, licensure being one, and that's fairly self-explanatory, evaluation outcomes, and that could come in a number of different forms. In fact, even after implementation of the teacher evaluation law, those things can be locally negotiated in multiple forms. And then thirdly is the seniority, which is the tiebreaker or secondary criteria, if you will.
Representative Dietrich.
So I just need you to be very clear with that. What do you mean that is a tiebreaker?
Representative Peterson.
Let us just say that two teachers of equal effectiveness is deemed by the evaluation. One has 20 years on the job and another has 5. The 20-year teacher still retains their job, all other things being equal, essentially. So if they're a social studies teacher, they're both social studies teachers, and one has 5 years, the other has 20, we still give deference to seniority.
Representative Dietrich.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's funny.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel compelled to speak about this. I hadn't intended to because this was an informational hearing only. It came to this committee almost as an afterthought or maybe simply for PR purposes, since it already has passed off the House floor and gone to conference committee. I'm a bit skeptical about the role of the committee actually in the process at this point, since we actually are here in no manner except to be listeners. But there are a few points I simply have to speak to. Unfortunately, a number of the people who made their points have left the room, but it was noted that we ought not to be talking about research here, that we certainly didn't agree about the importance of a high-quality teacher in the classroom. And absolutely, that research is not at stake. But there is an abundance of research that is at stake, and that is, what are the performance measures that we will use to decide whether teachers' futures are judged in terms of the evaluation outcome? There is tremendous wealth of evidence that those aren't come too easily. And I only wish that we would give due process, if you would accept that term, to the evaluation committee that we put in statute. We have a tremendous task force who has only begun their work, barely scratched the surface. And in their second meeting, they had a number of data experts, if you will, come to the table and say we would need at least 3 years to begin to understand whether we had data that could bear the weight of a high-stakes employment decision. So from my perspective, this isn't about keeping LIFO. I'm glad to say that seniority ought to be one of multiple measures. But to leap from that to using the evaluation tool that's not yet developed to make high-stakes decisions about people's employment is a leap of faith. It is not a research-based decision.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Reinert, and as you know, that has been one of the primary objections to the bill, is that it preempts the work of the working group. And what I would respond to that is, in constructing any tool, whether it be this tool or any other tool, you do so with its implementation and use in mind. And to intentionally, for this body or the department, to intentionally ill-inform that working group about the ramifications of how that tool is going to be used, I actually think is ill-advised. And I think that they ought to know exactly how that tool is going to be used in order to develop the correct tool. And that would be my response to that.
Representative Briner.
Well, this is a subject for a much more lengthy discussion, because I absolutely 100% disagree with you about this. I think that the group of experts brought to the table understands the consequence and potential implications of this tool, but I think you have to understand the weight any body of data can bear before you put a consequence of high stakes an employment decision on the basis of that tool. And I would say that the young parent who talked about the teacher who the district wanted to keep on the basis of all their apparent evaluations of that teacher's performance might be solely disappointed to find that this tool might not maintain that teacher. We don't know how this tool will function, and not to have the courage to face the consequences of the data that we gather and analyze it fully, to my mind, is cowardly.
Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have obviously a different point of view with you on that, and I would take objection to the use of the word cowardly. But to unpack the issue just a little bit more as it relates to teacher evaluations, as you know, the biggest area in question is the 35% linkage to student achievement. The other 65% is most likely going to use multiple measures that are currently in use. The Charlotte Danielson model, peer review, video observation, it could be parent survey, it could be a number of other factors locally negotiated. So really what you're talking about and calling into question, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is that 35% portion attached to student achievement. And on that basis, that is just one piece of the puzzle, one small piece of the puzzle. And I think that it ought to be included in the tool. It's already in statute, and to the degree that those decisions could be made in error based on that 35% portion, they can under current law, under the teacher evaluation law as signed by Governor Dayton, high-stakes decision-making can be made, those decisions can be made using that tool. So your objection would be not only to my bill, but also to the law that was signed by the governor last session.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you'd have to show me exactly what line and statute you're referring to, because I don't think that that's the case. But I am not only talking about the 35%. The entire 100% of the tool. I have attended every single meeting of the teacher evaluation group and hope to do so through the completion of the creation of this tool. And there are questions around a whole range of aspects of how we move from the best practice framework into an actual specific measurement tool that will give the kind of, that will turn what is primarily qualitative information into a tool that will allow us to make quantitative decisions. And that's a complex issue, and we still have a lot of experts to hear from, and I do think there's a road ahead of us on this. I'm not at all skeptical that we can get to a performance measure, but I want to give the process its due consideration and not assume we have the tool before it exists.
Mr. Chair, Representative Breiner, I think obviously we have a difference of opinion on whether or not we should inform the working group while they're actually developing the tool or whether we should modify it after the fact. I happen to believe one thing, you happen to believe another, and I respect your opinion on that. And what I would also say is that, well, I forgot what else I was going to say, but I'll leave it at that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Status quo is an injustice to the students right now because we have issues. We're trying to fix them. The testimony today was mostly nonpartisan, as it should be. This issue is about the kids, not political posturing. And although I give a lot of credence to the processes that go on, but when things take years, as stated by one of the testifiers, years, you have years of kids that aren't getting what they need. Now, most schools, I believe, are doing a wonderful job. There are issues. But that doesn't mean that the students that attend those schools don't deserve the best teachers. And this piece of legislation doesn't say we're going to throw all the senior teachers out. It says, let us at least consider the quality. And now we have dedicated administrators, dedicated school board members that are involved because they care about education and the kids. They're not going to go willy-nilly and destroy the system. They want to have the tools to do the best job. And by giving them this option, and it's not a, you must, you know, you have to do it this way. It's an option that they can use to keep the best teachers for those kids, to assign the teachers to the schools and the areas that they can best help the children. And that can be done now, as soon as the bill becomes effective. Not 3 years and four commissions and committees and discussions later, if it ever gets fully implemented. And that's the most frustrating thing, is the legislative process is slow, and there are few opportunities to make a difference today, tomorrow, next week. And this is one of the pieces of legislation that can make that difference. And I really enjoyed the testimony today, because it was from people across the spectrum that didn't care about the political issue. They cared about the kids. Their kids, their neighbors' kids, in their schools. Thank you.
Representative Fabian, you get the last word.
I'll pass. Thank you.
All right. Members, I've received a couple of... Representative Anzels?
Are you recognizing me?
Well, I did say your name, yeah. So, do you want me to stand, or what is...
Well, Representative Quam, you just invented political posturing.
Maybe I shouldn't have recognized you. Are you done, Representative Anzels? You can continue if you'd like.
Done.
Thank you. Members, Representative Peterson, thank you for the presentation and for the public testimony today. Members, I've received multiple requests that we not have a hearing tomorrow because of the activities in western Minnesota for the senator's funeral. And so I'm going to honor that request, and we are not going to be meeting tomorrow night. So we'll send out a committee. We'll send out an announcement. On that. So with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.